In the following interview with Dr. Westman, I want to change your viewpoint as what you see in the news as research studies. You know, the ones that say the ketogenic diet has now been linked to blah, blah, blah. Intermittent fasting now increases the risk of heart attacks. 99.9% of the time, they're BS. They're basically manufactured to degrade the ketogenic diet or related diets. And this is all part of a PR campaign to dissuade you or to put doubt in your mind. They could literally take a very tiny percentage and turn it into a very large percentage and still sort of not break the law. And we're going to talk about that. But I wanted to really increase your awareness on these observational studies, which were really not meant to prove causation at all. So with that said, let's dive right in. Check it out. So we have Dr. Eric Westman here, and I have some very interesting questions I want to ask him related to research studies. Hello, Dr. Westman.
Hello, Dr. Berg.
Hey, listen, a question I want to dive right into right off the very beginning is there's this term, relative risk versus absolute risk. And I see a lot of this happening where you know, research turns a very small percentage into a very large percentage to make it look a lot better than it really is. Can you kind of just give us the simplicity of what that means and where do the people use that?
Yeah. So typically when a company someone is trying to sell something, they want the number of the change to be as large as possible. And so I'm a master's level statistician. I went through clinical research training after becoming an internal medicine specialist. So I understand this perhaps more than most doctors because I spent a couple of years in the statistician world. But so let's say you have a treatment that lowers the risk of something from 10% to 5%. So let's say the outcome is resolution of antibiotic being used for some sort of infection. Now, you know, that's not a very good success rate, 10%. You know, you right. want 100%. But right. But if you go from 10% to 5%, that's a 5% absolute risk reduction. So looking at what percentage of people get the disease, 10% is 1 out of 10. Or here, resolution of the disease, 5% is 1 out of 20. So it doesn't sound very big, though, to say there's a 5% reduction, does it?
No, it doesn't sound.
But that's the absolute risk reduction, and that's what's important to the doctor, to the patient. But what a company can do, because everyone else does it, is they can take that 10% and say, because it went from 10% to 5%, it was a 50% reduction because 5% is 50% of 10%. So it's a legitimate statistic that 10% to 5% is a 50% reduction. So if I was telling you now you take this antibiotic, no, it's not a 5% absolute risk reduction. It's a 50% reduction, but that's really the relative risk reduction. And I know this sounds all gobbledygook, but what you want to know is what is your risk, not the relative risk. You want to know the absolute risk. Does that make sense?
Totally. And what I can't believe that's even legal to do that because the news takes that and runs with it. And then on top of that, some observational study that they're using, you could just make something sound really bad when it's really not that bad.
Well, yeah, so taking relative risks in observational studies now, I mean, this is where we're bombarded with research that red meat is terrible, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there are what are called observational studies. They're not experimental studies. You take people, you ask them what they eat. Typically, you don't go home and verify what they're eating. You just ask them. That's the first flaw of this kind of research. And then you follow them over time. And then these very small changes in what's called a relative risk. But this is different than that absolute risk, relative risk, which again is kind of confusing. But relative risk in an observational study doesn't mean it's causal or it doesn't prove like in an experiment, that there's actually a problem. And so red meat gets dinged with these very small relative risks. Hazard ratios is another term you'll see. And the like 1.4 is the risk, one being no risk, 1.4 being the risk with eating red meat for something, let's say. Well, that can be called a 40% increase in risk, because it has this relative risk, which is from asking people what they were eating and following them. I mean, that one is really, it's so bad. This taking epidemiology, observational studies, and saying that's proof of something, that there should be a law about that, actually.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I was reading about this, that cannot be used in a court of law. So someone actually adjudicated that these observational studies can't be used as evidence in court, which is very interesting. And yet news can take it, doctors can take it. And what we hear is red meat, 40% increase, when really what you want is something like, you know, so smoking, and this is the argument that's made, that there's never been a randomized trial of smoking causing lung cancer. But we know it causes lung cancer. But that's because the observational studies were 14 to 1, not 1.5 to 1. So it's like if you see an association that's 10-fold, 14-fold, we're starting to see some association there, maybe causal. But when we're talking about red meat it's people who don't want you to eat red meat for other reasons, not scientific reasons, who basically overgeneralize or overblow these very small findings. And that, actually, the legal world has said, no, we won't accept that.
Incredible. So observational studies are based on questionnaires, right? You have to, hopefully, a person remembers what they ate over a period of time.
Yeah, right. So let's do that. You know, what did you eat last week? You know, now, if you're a carnivore, that's a pretty easy response.
Right.
But most people, you know, have trouble remembering what they're eating yesterday, let alone last week, let alone over the last 6 months.
I could remember what I ate, I think, the last 2 days. But before that, I don't know what I ate.
Yeah. Well, and maybe our world isn't a fair comparison because most carb eaters are eating lots of different things. It's hard to remember. If you're in a certain set of foods, and you're not eating many carbs, you might be able to have a pretty good idea of what you've been eating. But we have to remember that these are people who are eating fast food, restaurant, other types of foods too. So the food frequency questionnaire is kind of a red flag. If you see that in a research study, that it's asking someone what they're eating over the last 6 months, it's hearsay, really, in terms of a court of law, because there's really no proof that they ate what they said.
So what's the purpose of observational studies if they're,
so in the statistician clinical research world, we call them hypothesis generating studies. So that it's kind of like animal research, the mouse, the rat, it generates hypotheses that need then to be tested again in a formal experiment. So, you know, if there was a large association, let's say red meat and cancer had a 5 to 1, not 1.4 to 1 increase, then most people would say, you know, this is something to look at seriously. So we call that hypothesis generating research in the research world. But the problem with the media and those researchers don't get it either. I mean, would you spend your life doing these studies and then say, hey, don't listen to me, wait for the, you know, doctors over at the other university to do an experiment on it? No, they want the attention and the notoriety, even though the research is what we call weak and hypothesis generating, not testing.
So basically, a lot of this research has become more PR. It's more public relations, right? I mean, it's just getting people to believe a certain way. Could it be possible that there could be some corruption here and there with research in different universities?
So, you know, that's where, how do you define corruption? You know, the friends I have who are in the research world, you know, they're not taking money under the table, or, you know, I don't see that, you know, when you think of a mob boss and you know, skimming money, the corruption is, or the bias, huge bias is, sometimes it's unwitting, though. I mean, so if you're a researcher and the only money that you can get to study something, it's very expensive to do research now. The only money comes from a pharmaceutical company. You're going to end up studying pharmaceuticals. You're going to study drugs. So it's very interesting. I saw an essay on this 20 years ago that said the amount of money it takes to do research now at universities is going to only allow drug companies to do research because it's so expensive to do it now. And so that plays into the, is it corrupt? Not, is it corrupt to only study pharmaceuticals and not lifestyle? Well, in a way it is, because, I mean, we know in our clinical practices that changing the lifestyle can be as powerful as 10 drugs. You know, sometimes drugs don't work all that well, and yet they're sold. And so, you know, that's a, but the doctor, the researcher doing the study is not doing anything wrong. They're just kind of haplessly studying where the money is. You know, the old saying is, you know, why does the drunk look for the keys under the light, the lamplight? It's because that's where the light is. You know, why do doctors study pharma drugs? Because that's where the money is.
Yeah, I think the word probably is not corrupt, but it's like, for example, it's when they studied glyphosate, you know, you have the company, of course, is like, no, it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. And then some researcher comes out and just shows that, not well, there's some animal studies, there's tumors going on, there's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But of course, then they had that somehow the journal retracted that data. So there's this control over research, publication, where it could be published, where it's not published. It's like there's a bit of a heavy hand there.
Sure. Well, in my experience, gosh, going back 20 years now, we tried to publish papers that had low-carb diets in them, low-carb, high-fat, like the Atkins diet, like we teach today. But back then, 20 years ago, it was hard to get fair peer review. So peer review is kind of the vetting of, so you get funding to do research, you do the research to get it published, you have to go through other humans who review it and say, yes, it's good enough, no, it's not. But so because the peer review was so against high-fat diets at the time, in fact, I kind of stuttered back then. We were studying a high-fat diet because, you know, it was just, you know, in some people's mind, it was wrong. But a new journal was created to allow for new reviewers and different, because so the field can be so insular and so much an echo chamber that you can't get a fair shake in some journals. So when I asked Richard Feynman, who I was working with more closely then, is this, can you do this? And he said, yeah, this happens all the time. So it's common in science and in the medical world that new journals will pop up and a new set of reviewers will be put together to give fair, critical, you know, still critical appraisals of the journal articles. Because I remember the first article I tried to get published on the Atkins diet, one of the reviewers said, we're not used to having papers funded by the doctor. Because I was honest. I said, Dr. Atkins funded this paper. And so, you know, that's not a scientific reason to reject a paper. But so there's funding to get funding, and then there's doing the research, and then there's the publication of it. All along the way, there can be censorship, there can be, you know, killing of a story or the classic study that was kind of put in the basement was the one that showed that the low fat diet didn't work at all. It was a Minnesota study, and years later, I think it was the relative of the researcher found all the paper. And when they were asked, why didn't they publish it? They said, well, it didn't come out the way we wanted it to. Oh my gosh. So, but that's the researcher being so entrenched in a paradigm that the researcher couldn't come to grips with the reality that what they were believing wasn't right. So I mean, all of in this, it can be conscious or unconscious, kind of a conscious bias and corruption happened recently. The Stanford study, the twin experiment that's gotten all these views on, it's a Netflix series, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the plant-based organization funded the plant-based researcher. And can you imagine they went around with TV cameras during this study? Now, you're not supposed to know what the results are going to be before the study's done. And, you know, but they sent camera crews around, and it basically led to a vegan propaganda film. And the science was, it was actually kind of made to make the vegan diet look really good when it might not be. It was a short-term study. They only focused on LDL cholesterol, not the triglyceride, HDL, abdominal circumference, blood sugar and blood pressure, which is called the metabolic syndrome. And so that one really, it was more an explicit, let's pay the university professor to do a study and have it come out in a certain way. And oh, by the way, we'll do a Netflix documentary series on it. Oh my
God. Yeah, because we know how it's going to go down. So let's just do that film during the process. Unbelievable.
That was bad. And that was recent. I mean, that's just this year. So we can't claim, you know, decades ago it was all bad. You know, it's still happening.
I wasn't sure if you did a video on this recent intermittent fasting causes heart attacks. Did you do a video on that yet?
No, not yet. Okay. Other folks have, and that was just so sad. It's one of those things I hope will just kind of fade away.
I mean, it was like, it was a poster, right? They had it on a poster. Yeah. It didn't even get, it's not even peer reviewed.
Yeah, so so people understand the process. So you could be a researcher, you do your research, you present it at a meeting. That means it hasn't even gone through the peer review process of someone else criticizing it, making you make changes and all. You present it at a meeting and the media picks it up and puts it in the news as if it was already vetted through the whole process, and it wasn't. So if you see a meeting presentation, be very skeptical or suspicious that, you know, this is still very preliminary. And yet, you know, you can see pot shots taken about high fat diets and heart disease every year. You can kind of expect that meeting will send out the media response, and it, you know, it goes everywhere. I mean, it hit one of the talk shows about how intermittent fasting causes heart attacks, and the study didn't show that at all.
And it's very interesting how coordinated all the news, all of a sudden, every single, overnight, every single news station has it, and they're putting out the same thing. It's like, you know, creating doubt again. Tell me a little bit about Harvard University and their objectivity with the studies and research. I think you mentioned something about that we can talk about.
Sure. Well, you know, Duke University, where I am, has three or four different diet programs, and you know, the keto diet is one of them. And Harvard is similarly has lots of different programs, and some people are doing randomized controlled trials, very, very elegant research in research labs. You know, that would be David Ludwig and the pediatric endocrinology group there. The School of Public Health at Harvard, however, is doing this nutritional epidemiology research. In fact, they wrote the book on nutritional epidemiology, and that's that type of study we were just being critical of, where you ask people what they think they were eating, and then you follow them over time and get these very small associations. When I've only had a few interactions with Dr. Willett. Professor Willett is basically the father of nutritional epidemiology, and he kind of says, well, Dr. Westman, he has a very limited view of what research is. And I mean, yeah, dang right. I want research that is clinically relevant, you know. I'm not into this hypothesis generating stuff. I want hypothesis testing research, is why we went into randomized trials 20 years ago on the low-carb keto diets. But so nutritional epidemiology in and of itself is sort of it's corrupt in the way that the companies that fund the research tend to get overrepresentation. And so there's always the, let's study whatever the company wants to have studied or look at. And, but you know, I don't, I don't think those researchers know that, again, they're kind of haplessly part of this process. They want to be important. Everyone looks to Harvard for the final answer when the research they're talking about is not final in any way. So, that's too bad. I wish nutritional epidemiology would be, you know, put way down on the list of people you go talk to, because that's where you get the red meat and heart disease, red meat and cancer associations that are so weak and small that they really don't matter in the clinical, in the world of clinical relevance. And that's confusing for so many people.
Yeah, especially because when you deal with any research paper, the average person cannot read it because it's, there's too many technical words. So then they rely on experts to interpret that secondhand. And then you have that interpretation. So, and then you have the study itself, the credibility. So it's like hard to win this argument with different studies. You have two people going back and forth, giving their interpretations, and the consumer's trying to make sense out of it. It's like they're just going from confusion to more confusion.
Well, so a shorthand version of it came from Harvard, must be great.
Right.
Needs to be nuanced to it came from the Harvard School of Public Health, so be careful. You know, if it comes from the Harvard pediatric, no, you need to kind of open the hood and at least read the abstract to see what type of research that it was. And then put it in my mind, if it's not humans, I can say, well, okay, it doesn't apply to my patients because my patients are humans. And then if it's epidemiology, then it's still hypothesis generating. It's early research. It's not, most people expect the research to be at the level of drug approval, right? You expect the drug to have gone through formal testing and vetting and review, and the nutritional epidemiology is nowhere near that level of certainty. And that's always been my expectation, that I wouldn't use something in my clinic unless it has a recommendation, unless it really has solid evidence behind it, not hypothesis generating, making questions, hypothesis testing, meaning answering the questions.
I guess it is difficult to do some of these studies, expensive, because you have to control what someone eats, and you have so many different factors. It is difficult to prove something, especially in the area of nutrition, because you have so many different factors, and how are you going to prove one? You're going to have to put them in a lab, and then okay, we have a control, and we're going to just feed them all the same food. That's just super expensive.
And yet it can be done, right? So David Ludwig, who's at Harvard in the pediatric endocrinology, decided to send people to a campus university that was not being used. So they basically, put people in a closed area so they couldn't get out and eat something else. Problem was COVID hit, and apparently it didn't follow up and get the information that they needed. But there are clever ways to find out what people are eating, to validate it, or to start people out with food and then see what they're eating at home. I kind of like that as a method, because it is expensive to feed people all the time, but at least some of the time you know exactly what they're eating, unless they're adding to it. If someone's going home and you don't follow them home, you never really know what they're doing. Although in my clinic, if I tell someone to do a low carb keto diet and they come back and they're losing weight, I'm pretty sure they're doing it. If I can tell at the door, if it's been a month and they haven't lost any weight, I can tell pretty much that they're having some carbs along the way. So there are proxies that can be used to, at least say that they're following the diet in general. A keto diet, you can check ketones. Urine ketones are pretty simple. Blood ketones, breath ketones. A more mixed diet program that doesn't have a biologic a change to measure is a little harder to know for sure what people are eating.
In your clinic, do you have people just come in there for weight loss, right?
All sorts of medical problems now.
Oh, okay.
No, the word's out that we reverse diabetes, obesity, a chronic heartburn, irritable bowel. I joke that I really should be a gastrointestinal specialist because all of these problems get better. Even with Nick Norwitz's experience, he's the medical student at Harvard who reversed his own ulcerative colitis.
Right.
There are more and more signals of the really severe and serious inflammatory bowel diseases getting better. But, you know, I'm a general internist by training, so I'm comfortable treating all of these different medical issues. And then a couple of years ago, someone ended up in my office without a pulse. It was because he had a left ventricular assist device implanted in his chest. Mm. And I became quickly brought up to speed. We didn't have these back in training. And so, no, I'll treat people with heart failure. This person had such bad heart failure. They had an implanted ventricular assist pump. And so our proof of that a low-carb keto diet would reverse obesity, those were published, you know, in the early 2000s. And my latest, you know, last 10 years really has been applying this method to other diseases within the chronic medical disease world we have. You know, so many things get better. It's so unbelievable. People don't believe it, you know?
Right. Have you ever had a patient kind of cheat on the diet and you're like, wow, you're not getting results. You're not cheating. And they're not telling you, not coming clean. Have you ever had that?
Oh, all the time. And if there's no weight loss, I go in and I kind of know they're eating carbs. Mm-hmm. They know they're eating carbs. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to, it's not a cat and mouse game. It's more, you know, how can I help? And I ask people if they're hungry. And if there's no hunger, I'm pretty sure they're not eating carbs, if you're eating carbs, you don't know what I'm talking about. If you're not eating carbs, you understand exactly what I'm talking about. So I'll ask, are you hungry? And if someone says yes, and then I'll say, well, what are you craving? And then they'll say, oh, well, bananas. And they're like, you're having a banana because you're craving what you eat. You know, so that's a little game I play with the students and residents before I go in. So, you know, I'm going to ask them if they're hungry, and then they're going to tell us what they're eating. They'll fess up without me ever really calling them on the carpet about it. But, you know, for most people, it's addiction, habit eating, you know, this time of year, there's holidays, and you know, so those things you forgive and forget, just like teaching someone how to ride a bike. You know, what parent would be out there saying, you'll never be able to learn to ride this bike? You know, you're supportive. You always gently bring people back. And it's a great clinical practice, right?
Yeah, I have to, approach that question when I was in my clinic, really kind of in a safe environment, because boy, yeah. It's like you start, it's almost like they felt like they need to go to church with a confession or something. Because I remember this one gal, her husband came to me and said, you know, she's doing like 24 cookies a day. I'm like, what? She never told me that. So I very gently just said, hey, before you go, is there anything that you might be eating that might be kind of borders on not that healthy? And she goes, no, nothing. She looks down. what do you think about when I ask you that question? She just, her face turned red, got really embarrassed, and finally fessed up. And I'm like, it's okay. Just tell me what you're eating. So I've had to do that a lot. But, and then of course, Whole Foods was right next to me. And so I'd go in there for lunch and I would see these people by the brownies taking the little samples and stuff. And then they would, if they saw me across the distance, they would just bolt. I mean, they're out of there. So you got to be careful when you start getting into people's.
Well, but you know, it may seem paradoxical, but it the stricter you are, the easier it is. Right.
Yeah.
The more you bring in the addiction model of, you know, you can't quit alcohol by drinking every day. You can't quit smoking by having a cigarette every day. I mean, it just doesn't work. So this doesn't apply to everyone, but the problem children that I see are struggling with that idea that they don't really think it's addiction. because they've had it all their life. And I mean, I remember when my parents smoked, and they that no one thought it was an addiction. You know, doctors were promoting cigarettes. You know, more doctors smoke Camels. And now we just kind of look back in horror and just disbelief. I hope that's what's going to happen looking back to this time, years from now, when it's understood what sugar is really doing.
Yeah. You know,
it's just not right to have sugar at the grocery checkout. It's not right to tempt an addict with sugar all day long and at parties and all that. I mean, it would be poor form to, let's say your friend is an alcoholic, you know that. It would be poor form to offer them a drink at a party, right? An alcoholic drink. At least we've come that far. But yeah, the language around eating carbs is very interesting. People come in saying they cheated, they sinned. You know, I joke that I should have a little confessional and send people over there when they're really mad at themselves. But no, we understand that. Mm-hmm. Carbs will call your name and suck you back in. It's a hormonal and physiologic change, and most people don't understand that yet. They still think it's their willpower and it's all their fault, when really it's the food's fault.
Yeah, totally. Since you talked about that one point, I want to bring up, there's certain kind of gurus out there that are doing videos that are, you know, they go keto and they go more heart strict carnivore, and now they're adding tremendous amount of sugar, you know, like fruit, honey, and then a lot of, like, what, 400 grams of sugar. So what's your take on that diet?
You know, best I can tell, that these influencers didn't really have any major medical issue to solve, so they kind of got into this because of the popularity, and there, I see this frequently. You know, having been in this world 25 years, people come and go, and they're in it because it's radical, and then they leave. But so it seems to me that these folks have a metabolism that could always have tolerated the sugar, and there are those who can. I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to be healthy, but to have the person following them not understand that they can't do the same thing is too bad. And, you know, I wish you could have on these videos, you know, use at your own risk, because this person really didn't have to lose weight before they're telling you how to lose weight, you know? Yeah. So I don't know, metabolically, they're getting things mixed up, because when I talked to Jeff Volek, who is at Ohio State, he's the world's premier keto researcher now. He studied lots of different diets. But I ask him every year, should I stop recommending the keto diet to my patients? Have you learned anything? I mean, if anyone's going to learn it, he's going to see it. He's like on the crow's nest in the ship looking for the edge of the world. He said at a recent meeting, there's no evidence that a keto diet is harmful. There's no evidence. And it hit me, there is no evidence. It's all kind of fantasy. It's all kind of just fear in people's minds. And so I think these influencers are a little they're a little too selfish. They're only thinking about their own situation without regard to how it would impact other people. That's why I value you, Eric, and other people who've been in clinical practice, because you've seen it play out in other people, not just yourself.
There's a huge difference. You start, you know, you have these series, but then you find out, wow, that didn't work. So when you have actual people day in and day out, it makes a huge difference. And that's why some of these, the gurus, they haven't had practices. And what happens is, like, you haven't tested it out on other people yet, only yourself. And now you're going to put this out there. You're going to confuse a lot of people. Of course, if I tell you, hey, listen, you can do all the sugar now. You can have rice. You can have this. And of course, oh, really? Okay, good. So let me jump on board with that. So most people don't have the mitochondria to deal with that. And also, you know, they're just, we're talking more addictions, but it sounds good. Sounds like a great thing that, hey, could this be true?
Yeah. So beware of the source of information.
Yeah. So I wanted to just touch on, I'm just curious about research funding. So you have governmental research, the government, well, we taxpayers spend money on research. And then you have universities that, I guess, do research. Does Big Pharma actually pay for their own research, or do they get funding from us?
Well, it's all kind of muddled together. Yes, a company has an ability to have a researcher do a study at a university or multiple universities if they're doing a phase three trial for medication approval. You're going to have lots of universities, lots of professors, lots of participants, and they fund the study directly themselves. And it's expensive to do. The government funding, so like at the National Institutes of Health, it is our tax dollars. And in the infinite wisdom of the researchers, it's almost like the fox guarding the hen house here, they decided to say that it's the rule or the common practice. You have to know the mechanism of what's going on. So the National Institutes of Health is trying to find the mechanism of disease. And this gets a little off base or off the mark. So what I find is I treat people using something that fixes people, but I don't know the mechanism. And so I couldn't write a grant that said, here's what we're studying, here's the possible mechanism, or selecting out, just isolating one thing, because what we do, it has many different mechanisms. I mean, it affects all the satiety hormones. I mean, it's like, you don't need Ozempic, just do a low carb diet. Hunger goes away, you get fuller sooner. I mean, you know, but so the NIH, our tax dollars, basically the basic scientists got control to say, you have to have research that's finding the mechanism. Now, occasionally there are NCAM or other small groups that fund actually research with patient outcomes as the most important thing. But that's why I think to this day, I know of maybe two or three NIH researchers who are funded to study a low carb keto diet for diabetes or obesity. We've been using that for 25 years in research and clinic at Duke. I mean, I guess you could argue we don't need to do research on it anymore, but the distraction of trying to find the mechanism means that you're not going to be seeing a whole lot of outcome, you know, this patient gets better kind of research from the NIH, which is kind of sad. I mean, an example of that, I knew I could fix fatty liver 15 years ago. I had a small study. We published the paper. I went to one of my colleagues here at Duke, who is an NIH-funded researcher, and she was like, well, great. You know, didn't change her practice because she wants people to come in with the fatty liver to be able to do the drug study or other manipulative study. She didn't want to fix it. She wanted to figure out what the mechanism was in order to come up with a new treatment to fix it that a drug company basically could pick up. And that, so that's the kind of interplay between the drug companies and the NIH research mechanistic model, is that we find the mechanism and then a drug company can take advantage of that. And, you know, ideally help people, but it is distraction from, hey, let's change the diet and everything is better. It's right. Almost like our diet does too much.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that I like what you're doing is you're doing all these different educational things in the seminars, you're educating your patients, because I think unless a person understands in the basics, cholesterol, what to eat, they're not going to really, you know, they're dependent on the next so-called guru that comes around. So you also have a series of courses even on your website. You have one on cholesterol, you have also one on, I think, keto, right?
Yes. So in order to get this information to people outside of our clinic at Duke, you know, there are only so many people can come through the door a day. We created a company called Adapt Your Life, and Adapt Your Life Academy is where we let people get access to this information through online courses. I'm pretty excited. We've taught now more people online the Keto Made Simple course than I teach in my clinic, just because you can scale it up, right?
Wow.
And so we have exciting courses on diabetes, reversing diabetes. You can actually sign up to get on a waiting list for that course. And then cholesterol, we asked Mike and Mary Dan Eads, who wrote Protein Power, to do a course on protein. We asked a chef to do a course on how to cook in a keto way, a cancer specialist. So our idea is to grow people in this area to give courses, I mean, establish people in the field and make that available to everyone.
I think that's the key. The key is the more you know, then you can't be adversely affected by these other things. So I think that's a really smart idea. So I'm going to put your website down in the descriptions, and I highly recommend everyone check it out, get more data, more training. And I just like Dr. Westman's style of teaching. It's simple. He keeps it really simple. And I appreciate that. So thank you so much for doing this interview. And I'm sure we'll be talking real soon.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for all you're doing, Eric.
Absolutely.